a lull. He was born in the hotel where his mother worked. The hotel had only three dark rooms, which gave on a courtyard behind the bar. Beyond was another smaller patio with many doors. This was where the servants lived and where Allah spent his childhood. The Greek who owned the hotel had sent Allah's mother away. He was indignant because she, a girl of 14, had dared to give birth while she was working for him. She would not say who the father was, and it angered him to reflect that he himself had not taken advantage of the situation while he had had the chance. He gave the girl 3 months' wages and told her to go home to Marrakesh. Since the cook and his wife liked the girl and offered to let her live with them for a while, he agreed that she might stay on until the baby was big enough to travel. She remained in the back patio for a few months with the cook and his wife, and then one day she disappeared, leaving the baby behind. No one heard of her again. As soon as Allah was old enough to carry things, they set him to work. It was not long before he could fetch a pail of water from the well behind the hotel. The cook and his wife were childless, so that he played alone. When he was somewhat older, he began to wander over the empty tableland outside. There was nothing else up here but the barracks, and they were enclosed by a high, blind wall of red adobe. Everything else was below in the valley, the town, the gardens, and the river winding southward among the thousands of palm trees. He could sit on the point of rock far above and look down at the people walking in the alleys of the town. It was only later that he visited the place and saw what the inhabitants were like. Because he had been left behind by his mother, they called him a son of sin and laughed when they looked at him. It seemed to him that in this way they hoped to make him into a shadow in order not to have to think of them as real and alive. He awaited with dread the time when he would have to go each morning to the town and work. For the moment, he helped in the kitchen and served the officers from the barracks, along with a few motorists who passed through the region. He got small tips in the restaurant and free food and lodging in a cell of the servants' quarters, but the Greek gave him no wages. Eventually, he reached an age when this situation seemed shameful, and he went of his own accord to the town below and began to work, along with other boys of his age, helping to make the mud bricks people used for building their houses. Living in the town was much as he had imagined it would be. For 2 years, he stayed in a room behind a blacksmith shop, leading a life without quarrels and saving whatever money he did not have to spend to keep himself alive. Far from making any friends during this time, he formed a thorough hatred for the people of the town, who never allowed him to forget that he was a son of sin, and therefore not like the others, but mischot, damned. Then he found a small house, not much more than a hut, in the palm groves outside the town. The rent was low and no one lived nearby. He went to live there, where the only sound was the wind in the trees, and avoided the people of the town when he could. One hot summer evening, shortly after sunset, he was walking under the arcades that faced the town's main square. A few paces ahead of him, an old man in a white turban was trying to shift a heavy sack from one shoulder to the other. Suddenly it fell to the ground, and Alal stared as two dark forms flowed out of it and disappeared into the shadows. The old man pounced upon the sack and fastened the top of it, at the same time beginning to shout, "Look out for the snakes! Help me find my snakes!" Many people turned quickly around and walked back the way they had come. Others stood at some distance watching. A few called to the old man, "Find your snakes fast and get them out of here. Why are they here? We don't want snakes in this town." Hopping up and down in his anxiety, the old man turned to Allah. "Watch this for me a minute, my son." He pointed at the sack lying on the earth at his feet, and snatching up a basket he had been carrying, went swiftly around the corner into an alley. Allah stood where he was. No one passed by. It was not long before the old man returned, panting with triumph. When the onlookers in the square saw him again, they began to call out, this time to Allah, "Show that Barani the way out of the town. He has no right to carry those things in here. Out, out." Allah picked up the big sack and said to the old man, "Come on." They left the square and went through the alleys until they were at the edge of town. The old man looked up then, saw the palm trees black against the fading sky ahead, and turned to the boy beside him. "Come on," said Allah again, and he went to the left along the rough path that led to his house. The old man stood perplexed. "You can stay with me tonight," Allah told him. "And these," he said, pointing first at the sack and then at the basket, "they have to be with me." Allah grinned. "They can come." in the basket. "I'm not like the rest of them here," he said. It made him feel good to hear the words being spoken. He made a contemptuous gesture. "Afraid to walk through the square because of a snake? You saw them." The old man scratched his chin. "Snakes are like people," he said. "You have to get to know them. Then you can be their friends." Alal hesitated before he asked, "Do you ever let them out?" "Always," the old man said with energy. "It's bad for them to be inside like this. They've got to be healthy when they get to Taradant, or the old man there won't buy them." He began a long story about his life as a hunter of snakes, explaining that each year he made a voyage to Taradant to see a man who bought them for the Aisawa snake charmers in Marrakesh. Alal made tea while he listened and brought out a bowl of keef paste to eat with the tea. Later, when they were sitting comfortably in the midst of the pipe smoke, the old man chuckled. Alal turned to look at him. "Shall I let them out?" "Fine, but you must sit and keep quiet. Move the lamp nearer." He untied the sack, shook it a bit, and returned to where he had been sitting. Then in silence, Alal watched the long bodies move cautiously out into the light. Among the cobras were others with markings so delicate and perfect that they seemed to have been designed and painted by an artist. One reddish-gold serpent, which coiled itself lazily in the middle of the floor, he found particularly beautiful. As he stared at it, he felt a great desire to own it and have it always with him. The old man was talking. "I've spent my whole life with snakes," he said. "I could tell you some things about them. Did you know that if you give them majun, you can make them do what you want and without saying a word? I swear by Allah." Alal's face assumed a doubtful air. He did not question the truth of the other's statement, but rather the likelihood of his being able to put the knowledge to use. For it was at that moment that the idea of actually taking the snake first came into his head. Suddenly, he felt a great impatience. "Put them away so I can cook dinner," he whispered. Then he sat admiring the ease with which the old man picked up each one by its head and slipped it into the sack. Once again, he dropped two of the snakes into the basket, and one of these, Alal noted, was the red one. He imagined he could see the shining of its scales through the lid of the basket. As he set to work preparing the meal, Alal tried to think of other things. Then, since the snake remained in his mind in spite of everything, he began to devise a way of getting it. While he squatted over the fire in the corner, he mixed some keef paste in a bowl of milk and set it aside. The old man continued to talk. "That was good luck, getting the two snakes back like that in the middle of the town. You can never be sure what people are going to do when they find out you're carrying snakes. Once in El Kila, they took all of them and killed them, one after the other, in front of me. A year's work. I had to go back home and start all over again." Even as they eat, Allah saw that his guest was growing sleepy. How will things happen, he wondered. There was no way of knowing beforehand precisely what he was going to do, and the prospect of having to handle the snake worried him. It could kill me, he thought. Once they had eaten, drunk tea, and smoked a few pipes of kief, the old man lay back on the floor and said he was going to sleep. Alal sprang up. "In here," he told him, and led him to his own mat in an alcove. The old man lay down and swiftly fell asleep. Several times during the next half hour, Alal went to the alcove and peered in. But neither the body in its burnous nor the head in its turban had stirred. First he got out his blanket, and after tying three of its corners together, spread it on the floor with the fourth corner facing the basket. Then he set the bowl of milk and kief paste on the blanket. As he loosened the strap from the cover of the basket, the old man coughed. Allah stood immobile, waiting to hear the cracked voice speak. A small breeze had sprung up, making the palm branches rasp one against the other. But there was no further sound from the alcove. He crept to the far side of the room and squatted by the wall, his gaze fixed on the basket. Several times he thought he saw the cover move slightly, but each time he decided he had been mistaken. Then he caught his breath. The shadow along the base of the basket was moving. One of the creatures had crept out from the far side. It waited for a while before continuing into the light. But when it did, Alain breathed a prayer of thanks. It was the red and gold. When finally it decided to go to the bowl, it made a complete tour around the edge, looking in from all sides, before lowering its head toward the milk. Alain watched, fearful that the foreign flavor of the kefalés might repel it. The snake remained there without moving. He waited a half hour or more. The snake stayed where it was, its head in the bowl. From time to time, Alain glanced at the basket to be certain that the second snake was still in it. The breeze went on, rubbing the palm branches together. When he decided it was time, he rose slowly, keeping an eye on the basket where apparently the other snake still slept. He reached over and gathered together the three tied corners of the blanket. Then he lifted the fourth corner so that both the snake and the bowl slid to the bottom of the improvised sack. The snake moved slightly, but he did not think it was angry. He knew exactly where he would hide it, between some rocks on the dry riverbed. Again, out of the basket. Stay where you are and I'll find them. It was not long before the old man grunted with satisfaction. I have the black one, he cried. Alain didn't look up from the corner where he crouched, and the old man came over waving a cobra. Now I've got to find the other one. He put the snake away and continued to search. When the fire was blazing, Alain turned and said, do you want me to help you look for it? No, no, stay where you are. Alain boiled the water and made the tea, and still the old man was crawling on his knees, lifting boxes and pushing sacks. His turban had slipped off and his face ran with sweat. Come and have tea, Alain told him. The old man did not seem to have heard him at first. Then he rose and went into the alcove, where he rewound his turban. When he came out, he sat down with Alal and they had breakfast. Snakes are very clever, the old man said. They can get into places that don't exist. I've moved everything in this house. After they had finished eating, they went outside and looked for the snake between the close-growing trunks of the palms near the house. When the old man was convinced that it was gone, he went sadly back in. That was a good snake, he said at last. And now I'm going to Tarudant. They said goodbye, and the old man took his sack and basket and started up the road toward the highway. As he worked, Alal thought of the snake, but it was not until sunset that he was able to go to the rocks in the wood and pull out the blanket. He carried it back to the house in a high state of excitement. Before he untied the blanket, he filled a wide dish with milk and kef paste and set it on the floor. He ate 3 spoonfuls of the paste himself and sat back to watch, drumming on the low wooden tea table with his fingers. Everything happened just as he had hoped. The snake came slowly out of the blanket and very soon had found the dish and was drinking the milk. As long as it drank, he kept drumming. When it had finished and raised its head to look at him, he stopped and it crawled back inside the blanket. Later that evening, he put down more milk and drummed again on the table. After a time, the snake's head appeared. And finally all of it, and the entire pattern of action was repeated. That night, and every night thereafter, Alal sat with the snake, while with infinite patience, he sought to make it his friend. He never attempted to touch it, but soon he was able to summon it, keep it in front of him for as long as he pleased, merely by tapping on the table, and dismiss it at will. For the first week or so, he used the kef paste. Then he tried the routine without it. In the end, the results were the same. After that, he fed it only milk and eggs. Then one evening, as his friend lay gracefully coiled in front of him, he began to think of the old man and formed an idea that put all other things out of his mind. There had not been any kef paste in the house for several weeks, and he decided to make some. He bought the ingredients the following day, and after work he prepared the paste. When it was done, he mixed a large amount of it in a bowl with milk and set it down for the snake. Then he himself ate 4 spoonfuls, washing them down with tea. Undressed and moving the table so that he could reach it, stretched out naked on a mat near the door. This time he continued to tap on the table, even after the snake had finished drinking the milk. It lay still observing him, as if it were in doubt that the third familiar drumming came from the brown body in front of him. Seeing that even after a long time it remained where it was, staring at him with its stony yellow eyes, Alal began to say to it over and over, "Come here." He knew it could not hear his voice, but he believed it could feel his mind as he urged it. "You can make them do what you want without saying a word," the old man had told him.
Although the snake did not move, he went on repeating his command, for by now he knew it was going to come. And after another long wait, all at once it lowered his head and began to move toward him. It reached his hip and slid along his leg. Then it climbed up his leg and lay for a time across his chest. Its body was heavy and tepid, its scales wonderfully smooth. After a time it came to rest, curled in the space between his head and his shoulder. By this time the keeping paste had completely taken over Corral's mind. He lay in a state of pure delight, feeling the snake's head against his own. Without a thought, saying that he and the snake were together. The patterns forming and melting down in his eyelids seemed to be the same ones that had covered the snake's back. Now and then, in a huge, frenzied movement, they all swirled up and shattered into fragments, which swiftly became one great yellow eye, split through the middle by the narrow vertical pupil of the pulse of his own heartbeat. Then the eye would recede, through shifting shadow and sunlight, until only the designs of the scales were left, swarming with renewed insistence as they merged and separated. At last the eye returned, so huge this time that it had no edge around it, its pupil dilating to form an aperture almost wide enough for him to enter. As he stared at the blackness within, he understood that he was being slowly propelled toward the opening. He put out his hands to touch the polished surface of the eye on each side. As he did this, he felt the pull of the vision. He stood through the crack and was swallowed by darkness. On awakening, Alal felt that he had returned from somewhere far away. He opened his eyes and saw, very close to him, what looked like the flank of an enormous beast, covered with coarse, stiff hair. There was a repeated vibration in the air, like distant thunder curling around the edges of the sky. He sighed, or imagined that he did, for his breath made no sound. Then he shifted his head a bit to try to see beyond the mass of hair. Next he saw the ear, and he knew that he was looking at his own head from the outside. He had not expected this. He had hoped only that his friend would come in and share his mind with him. But it did not strike him as being at all strange. He merely said to himself that now he was seeing through the eyes of the snake rather than through his own. Now he understood why the serpent had been so wary of him. From here, the boy was a monstrous creature, with all the bristles on his head, his breathing that vibrated inside him like a far-off storm.
He uncoiled himself and glided across the floor to the alcove. There was a break in the mud wall wide enough to let him out. When he had pushed himself through, he lay full length on the ground in the crystalline moonlight, staring at the strangeness of the landscape where shadows were not shadows. He crawled around the side of the house and started up the road toward the town, rejoicing in a sense of freedom different from any he had ever imagined. There was no feeling of having a body, for he was perfectly contained in the skin that covered him. It was beautiful to caress the earth with the lengths of his belly as he moved along the silent road, smelling the sharp veins of wormwood in the wind. When the voice of the muezzin floated out over the countryside from the mosque, he could not hear it, or know that within the hour the night would end. On catching sight of a man ahead, he left the road and hid behind a rock until the danger had passed. But then as he approached the town, there began to be more people, so that he let himself down into the Segya, the deep ditch that went along beside the road. Here the stones and clumps of dead plants impeded his progress. He was still struggling along the floor of the Segya, pushing himself around the rocks and through the dry tangles of matted stalks left by the water when dawn began to break. The coming of daylight made him anxious and unhappy. He clambered up the bank of the Segya and raised his head to examine the road. A man walking past saw him, stood quite still, and then turned and ran back. Alal did not wait. He wanted now to get home as fast as possible. Once he felt the thud of a stone as it struck the ground somewhere behind him. Quickly he threw himself over the edge of the Segya and rolled squirming down the bank. He knew the terrain here. Where the road crossed the wed, there were two culverts not far apart. A man stood at some distance ahead of him with a shovel, peering down into the Segya. Alal kept moving, aware that he would reach the first culvert before the man could get to him. The floor of the tunnel under the road was ribbed with hard little waves of sand. The smell of the mountains was in the air that moved through. There were places in here where he could have hidden, but he kept moving and soon reached the other end. Then he continued to the second culvert and went under the road in the other direction, emerging once again into the Segya. Behind him, several men had gathered at the entrance to the first culvert. One of them was on his knees, his head and shoulders inside the opening. He now set out for the house in a straight line across the open ground, keeping his eye on the clump of palms beside it. The sun had just come up, and the stones began to cast long bluish shadows. All at once, a small boy appeared from behind some nearby palms, saw him, and opened his eyes and mouth wide with fear. He was so close that Alal went straight to him and bit him in the leg. The boy ran wildly toward the group of men in the Segya. Alal hurried on to the house, looking back only as he reached the hole between the mud bricks. Several men were running among the trees toward him. Swiftly, he glided through into the alcove. The brown body still lay near the door, but there was no time, and Alal needed time to get back to it, to lie close to his head and say, "Come here." As he stared out into the room at the body, there was a great pounding on the door. The boy was on his feet at the first blow, as if a spring had been released, and Alal saw with despair the expression of total terror in his face, in the eyes with no mind behind them. The boy stood panting, his fists clenched. The door opened, and some of the men peered inside. Then, with a roar, the boy lowered his head and rushed through the doorway. One of the men reached out to seize him, but lost his balance and fell. An instant later, all of them turned and began to run through the palm grove after the naked figure. Even when, from time to time, they lost sight of him, they could hear the screams, and then they would see him, between the palm trunks, still running. Finally, he stumbled and fell face downward. It was then that they caught him, bound him, covered his nakedness, and took him away to be sent one day soon to the hospital at Bir Rashid. That afternoon, the same group of men came to the house to carry out the search they had meant to make earlier. Alal lay in the alcove, dozing. When he awoke, they were already inside. He turned and crept to the hole. He saw the man waiting out there, a club in his hand. The rage had always been in his heart. Now it burst forth. As if his body were a whip, he sprang out into the room. The men nearest him were on their hands and knees, and Alal had the joy of pushing his fangs into two of them before a third severed his head with an axe.
Rage, 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 rage. rage.
As if his body were whipped, he sprang out into the room. The men nearest him were on their hands and knees, and Allah had the joy of pushing his fangs into two of them before a third severed his head with an axe. Pushing his fangs into two of them before a third severed his head with an axe.